This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Today, we'll chat with the artistic director and conductor and keyboardist of a group of musicians about whom the New York Times has written that they are one of the most vital and original ensembles on the American music scene. The ensemble is called Alarm Will Sound, and we'll speak with Alan Pearson. He and a small band of musicians formed a new music ensemble while studying at the Eastman School of Music back in the 90s. Upon graduation, they decided to keep it going, and with the encouragement of composers such as Steve Reich, soon found themselves presenting important and impactful concerts in New York City, such as the Composer Portrait Series, staged by Miller Theater at Columbia University. They now perform all over the globe and have centers in New York, as well as St. Louis, specifically the Mizzou Festival at the University of Missouri. They have had major works by major composers written specifically for them, such as John Adams' Son of Chamber Symphony, paired with his original work on the group's latest recording. They also mine the composing talents of members of the ensemble. You're listening to a track from a disc devoted to the music of composer clarinetist Derek Bermel, one-time artist-in-residence at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, now artistic director of the American Composers Orchestra. This is the final movement, Itaparica, from his Canzonas Americanas, also featuring here the voice of Luciana Souza. Alarm Will Sound bills themselves as a band. They are also trailblazing and doing significant work in productions and events that cross genres, styles, and disciplines with theater, dance, and video. I spoke with Alan Pearson at his apartment in New York City a few weeks back. Very happy to be talking here today with Alan Pearson from Alarm Will Sound.
Thanks, David.
Congrats on, do you consider yourselves now past the 20-year mark? Just at least as far as an ensemble, right?
Not quite yet. We started in 2001, so we have
a 96 is kind of that's the embryo years, right?
I guess, although that was a different group. When was it? 97. It was 97. Okay. But that wasn't Alarm Will Sound. There was a group at Eastman that... Okay. A bunch of us who went on to found Alarm Will Sound were part of starting called OSEA, which is a student-run group that still exists at Eastman, and which was the laboratory in which Alarm Will Sound was cooked up.
Okay.
Alarm Will Sound is just...
All right, well, you'll get there soon enough. Hopefully we'll all get there.
Yes,
let's put it that way. Right. That's where I actually want to start. I want to start with a topic which I will then, nice and cyclic form, revisit at the end of our chat.
Cool.
It's the fact that you had this core of you guys who were at Eastman, and you saw the need to form an ensemble like this.
Yeah.
Why? Well, take us back to the late 90s. Why did you find that need? What was the burning issues?
Yeah. So remembering what it was like in the late 90s, there were a couple of big gaps that we saw in the contemporary American music scene. One was that every country in Europe, it seemed, had these national new music ensembles that, you know, played the new music of the country and international new music and that toured. It was the London Sinfonietta in the UK. It was like Ensemble Intercontemporain in France and Ensemble Moderne in Germany. And it was Steve Reich who said to us when he came to visit Eastman in 1999, America needs one of those and you guys should try to do it. Huh. So that was really the beginning of that thought. And then also, I remember being struck in the 90s by how sterile much of the new music scene seemed. There were so many concerts that were kind of dry and academic feeling, which were really just about, you know, playing notes on the page, going through, you know, whatever, four or six pieces that, you know, maybe had some theme that connected them, but that really weren't much, didn't add up to much of an overall experience, even if the music was really good and even if the playing was good, was decent. And we were interested in doing something more theatrical and bringing more of a concern for an overall performative experience to new music.
I mean, Bang on the Can had been going for a while, but you had to, that was specific, the uptown, downtown thing here.
Right.
And you had the West Coast, maybe the San Francisco area, you could find things, but maybe not on a consistent basis. Yeah, you're right. It was.
Yeah, and the West Coast, I don't know as much what was happening there. Bang on the Can, we were very much aware of.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, definitely among the people that we looked to as kind of parents. Bang on the Can, Kronos Quartet, Steve Reich Ensemble, Philip Glass Ensemble, those were all groups that we saw as sort of our inspirations and progenitors. You know, Bang on the Can, it seemed to us, was doing a fairly specific kind of repertoire and doing it really well and performing it with a lot of energy and charisma and the kind of panache that we wanted to bring too.
Right.
We were interested in doing a broader repertoire and also in looking at moving in a more theatrical direction.
So you're at Eastman, you get this kind of imperative from Steve Reich, which is pretty heavy, and then you graduate.
Yeah.
So now... It didn't disband. Huh. You made the decision, let's keep it going, but now you're in the quote-unquote real world, which means there has to be a sustainability to this.
Yeah.
So take us to that step to say, let's keep it going with a question mark.
Yeah, right. It definitely was a question mark. And even what the it was,
right,
was a question mark. You know, a turning point, there were a couple turning points for what became Alarm Will Sound, all of which were really around the music of Steve Reich. One was getting this chance for Cantaloupe, Bang on a Can's record label, to put out a recording of our performance of Tehillim. That was really exciting for us. We got an invitation from Steve Reich and Nonesuch to record another Reich piece, Music for a Large Ensemble. And then we got a chance to go to the Miller Theater in New York City, this is back when George Steele was running it, and do a live show of Tehillim and the Desert Music. So those three opportunities all came our way around the same time. And at the time, we were OTHEA. We were this student-run new music group at the Eastman School. And it was when all those opportunities were coming our way that it kind of hit us, hit me certainly, and other people too. Wait a minute, it seemed like a loss to take all these opportunities and then walk away from the organization that was going to benefit from them.
Yeah.
And so the plan we cooked up was to have Alarm Will Sound be a kind of spin-off, a new organization whose membership would be drawn from some of the people who had learned to work together through OTHEA and that would now go off and start their own ensemble.
So the commitment to new music, there's two other parameters. One would be, was it from the start, this will be a true chamber group, one on a part. How would you handle instrumentation? Would you say, composers, here's what we have? Or would it be malleable? How did you handle that question? How would you make up this ensemble?
Right. That was something we talked a lot about. And it's still something that we talk about sometimes. What we decided was to go with a one on a part instrumentation.
Right.
There were certain pieces that were like core pieces of the repertoire that were our inspiration for that. Pieces like the John Adams Chamber Symphony, the Ligeti Chamber Concerto, Ligeti Piano Concerto, Schoenberg Chamber Symphony. You know, these really like major seminal works that outlined this basic kind of instrumentation for us. You know, there were things we debated, like would we have a harp? Would we have two clarinets? How many percussionists would we have? But the basic outlines of the instrumentation came from those pieces. And we also made a decision that's had a lot of ramifications, but I think it's been a good one for us, that we would be a group that would always appear basically in the same configuration, so that when composers write for us, we do ask that they write for the whole instrumentation. And you know, we've made a couple of exceptions over the years, but we really wanted not to just be a call list or a roster of performers that could be drawn on for one project or another, but rather to be really a band in a more conventional and fixed sense of that word.
So the third leg of the stool is who, and we're back there still back at the beginning.
Sure, yeah, okay.
Who would you play for? Who were going to be your audience?
So, you know, when we were in Rochester, there was an amazing audience there for new music.
Right.
And I remember when Steve Reich came there in 1999, the house was packed. It was an amazing experience having this, you know, very old world seeming concert venue at, you know, this highly esteemed school be packed with people who were thrilled to come hear Steve Reich music. When we started getting outside of Eastman and, you know, looking to establish a Laramore sound, build it, develop an audience for it, at the beginning we decided that, you know, as an unknown name, that the way we were going to get an audience was through composers who already had a following and through presenters that already had a following. Okay. So when we got a sold out house for our first show in New York City in 2001, it wasn't because people said, oh my God, Alarm Will Sound, I have to go hear Alarm Will Sound. It was because people said, wow, Steve Reich, Tahiti in the Desert music, I want to hear that concert. And maybe like, oh, Miller Theater, yeah, I trust what Miller Theater does. So, you know, those were the things that brought in audiences in the early days for us. Very much the long-term plan was to gradually try to pivot that so that it went from people coming to see, you know, the composer we were playing or the series that was presenting us to people coming to see Alarm Will Sound.
Yeah.
But that was, we knew that would be a long process. And so, you know, we really accepted at the beginning that it was going to be the composers and the presenters and that our programming should reflect that. You know, we did in the early days try to do unknown composers and presenter owned concerts.
Right. Yeah.
Here's Alarm Will Sound and their precursor Osia, led by my guest, the music director and conductor Alan Pearson, in the final section of Steve Reich's setting of texts from Psalms. This verses 4 to 6 of Psalm 150, the work called Tehillim. Thank you.
said the name, but many of my listeners, this is a new name to them, or just like, how the heck? So the way the name came about is a humorous story. I know you've told it a zillion times, but tell the story of how the name comes about.
Yeah, sure. So Alarm Will Sound is very much a collaborative organization. Everyone in the group participates, and we have lots of discussions. We debate and discuss things, you know, in great depth over long periods of time. And the name is no exception to that. When we were starting the group, we had a very animated discussion about possible name candidates and ended up with a really long list. I want to say like 300 possible names. It was a huge list of possible names for the ensemble. And there was, you know, heated debate about it. I remember some of the ones we ended up not using. So Gavin Chuck, Alarm Will Sound's managing director, was my workout buddy in those days. And we were at the gym, and I think doing bench presses, and Gavin saw the name Alarm Will Sound, the phrase Alarm Will Sound on an Exitor, and said, hey, how about Alarm Will Sound? And I thought about it, I said, oh yeah, that's not bad. I wasn't immediately a huge fan of the name, but you know, the things that Gavin found appealing about it, which I found appealing too, were the sense of it being a sort of, you know, forbidden or, you know, maybe dangerous place that you'd be going into. So, and with that came a sense of adventure, which we really liked the feeling of. And also just all the great free advertising. You know, having our name be something people would see everywhere without us having to pay for it seemed really great. Gavin also imagined there being lots of newspaper reviews and articles about us that would, you know, play with the name, which he was right. That did happen a lot. Yeah, and so there was a lot of debate. And
it starts with Ace when there's alpha listings of stuff. You guys are always there at the top of stuff. I just thought when I first heard the ensemble years and years and years ago, I thought there's a double-edged sword there. You have that imperative in the title, you know, Alarm Will Sound, you got to hear this, you know?
Right.
But it's also like telling people, you got to hear this, and you'll have a certain people who say, I don't have to hear anything. You know, it's that kind of stand-up. I just always thought of that. It has that sort of double sword to it. Hmm. But it's a fascinating name, and you're right. It does get people's attention.
Yeah.
And you're not the American contemporary ensemble.
Right.
You know? So that works. I was going to ask this later, but just how did you personally, and you've become to be, I don't know if you carry any keyboards, but kind of director, music director of this, and we should say, band.
Yeah.
So how did that happen for you as it plays itself out?
Yeah, that was how it was constructed. When we started the group, I was coming on board as the conductor and artistic director, and Gavin was the managing director. But it was very much in the DNA of the group from the beginning that it was going to be a collaborative ensemble, and that, you know, the group was not going to be just an expression of my ideas and my vision, but rather an expression of a collective vision. I mean, that part of my role as the artistic director was going to be to develop and harness the ideas and vision and skills of the group.
Because the one on the part, because you just like the term band more in its popular music sense than wind ensemble, concert band type thing, because you're got mixed, there's strings, there's percussion, and all this kind of stuff in there, vocals. But just the idea of this entity, which is kind of stable but fluid. You know, if that's,
well, it's right. It's stable and it's always the same players, accepting subs. We said, you know, someone's not available, and someone else has to fill in. But basically, it's the same personnel. It's only really fluid in the sense that people do lots of different things, and we try to be a little chameleon-like, so that, you know, I think there's an Alarm Will Sound ethos and an Alarm Will Sound attitude. In a way, deliberately, there is not an Alarm Will Sound, because, you know, we try to really sound different depending on what we're doing. And we have players who do all different kinds of things. So, you know, Courtney might be playing violin on one piece and playing piano or singing on another piece, because these are all things that she does. And there are lots of people in the group like that who, you know, have lots of different skills to bring. And they're all those things. You know, someone in Alarm Will Sound is not identified just by their instrument. They're a person who brings all the artistic and personal things they bring to the table. And that's part of the fun of the group.
You mentioned Miller Theater. Your composer portrait series, which you did there, really did help the group a lot. And you're right. Those are, for the most part, fairly well-known composers, maybe not as well-known as in the States as they should have been, but, you know, that type of thing. So let's start with composers. I mean, how do they get into the Alarm Will Sound orbit? How do they stay there? How do you form relationships? How do new ones come? I mean, talk about, and there's, you're just composing and happens within the band, within the group.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of it, actually.
Right.
So, I mean, talk about how you choose composers and music on those things.
Yeah, I mean, we're always on the lookout for new projects to take on, and there always are more ideas than we have time and money to make happen. At this point, we pretty much only play stuff that is written for us. you know, it's rare and only in a really particular situation where there's a particular reason for it that we will play an existing piece. For the most part, we're playing a stuff that's created for us. And so really, you know, what we're doing is developing projects and looking at composers to develop projects with us. Some of them come from inside the group. You know, as you said, we have a bunch of composers in the ensemble. Mm-hmm. But then also we work with people outside the group. And we try to really work with a range of composers in terms of, you know, backgrounds, age, kinds of music that they write. And more, I think we're doing full concert projects rather than, you know, 15, 20 minute pieces. So like right now we're starting a project with a composer named Mary Kuyumjin, who's an alumnus of our International Composers Festival that we run with Mizzou every summer. Mm-hmm. She came to that program, had this idea to do a piece based on the story of a Afghani refugee named Malad Yousufi. And so she's developing that as a project for us. And that program, that summer program, which is a great way to get to know Alarmable Sound, the Mizzou International Composers Festival, is a big engine for us in terms of developing relationships with composers. We work with a lot of composers, both senior established composers as well as young up-and-coming composers there every summer. And lots of projects come out of those relationships.
Yeah, I know, just, and that goes to my next question. I mean, last fall, I had Donica Dennehy on, of course, he did his The Hunger,
right?
Which he talked about. So, you know, we were all the way back in the late 90s and then 2001. I mean, was it always that the group would eventually, or apart from the start, or sort of multimedia projects, bringing in other arts, bringing in visuals? I mean, this was always going to be the case? And how much of that makes up what you do now?
Yeah, a lot of the work we do is multimedia and in some way theatrical, or at least more than just people playing notes sitting on a stage in front of music stands. And that was always part of the vision of the group. One of the OSEA projects, OSEA being again that Eastman Student Ensemble that was kind of the laboratory where Alarmable Sound was cooked up, one of the OSEA projects that was a real inspiration for Alarmable Sound was a production that our theatrical director, Nigel Maester, did of John Cage's songbooks in the late 90s. I think it was 2001, actually, that he did it. It's a really spectacular performance of songbooks. And Alarmable Sound has since done its own version of Cage's songbooks with Nigel. And the way that Nigel approached theater in that show was a real inspiration. For me, I was astonished by that performance.
Right.
And that was a real touchstone for how we started thinking about theater and Alarmable Sound. And we definitely went into Alarmable Sound thinking that theater and multimedia would be a part of what the ensemble's performance practice would be.
I mean, now in 2017, doing these kinds of projects, they almost have to be, I mean, you can go down a straight conservative road, but you want to draw in other people who would not be drawn into it if it were a strictly musical concert.
Yeah.
And that's, it's almost like another vein. You have to have that lifeblood blowing out of new people coming in, right? Either you're just going to have the same audience showed up every time for your concert.
Right, and that's part of, so there's another project that we started a few years ago, which is designed to address just that issue, is this program called Alarm System, which is a collaboration engine, basically. And it's largely funded by the Mellon Foundation. Every year, we work with a slate of two or three artists from all different genres who are deliberately outside of the usual, like, classical, you know, music commissioning, composing world. People who work in different ways, who may not be conservatory trained, who, you know, may not even read music, but are great musical creators in some way and have a practice of working that's different from what, you know, the usual, you know, composer goes off, writes a score and delivers it to us way of working. And so we work with some amazing artists through that program. Desky Martin and Wood, Valgeir Sigurdsson, Mira Kalix, Rashad Becker, have all gone through that program and created projects with us. Brian Reitzel, who's a great film composer. So that's ongoing for us, and the idea of that is to develop both new ways of working for us, and it's meant to be a process that challenges both us and the artists we're working with to expand themselves, expand ourselves. And also it's a way to cultivate new audiences, for sure.
Right. Have you ever found it a need? I mean, you have the Mizzou Festival, but to have a home, is that important to have, you know, this is where we perform?
Not necessarily. I think it's been valuable for us to have a reoccurring presence, you know, in one or more places. Which for us, it's, you know, New York and St. Louis, where we have the most regular presence. You know, a challenge with not having a home is, you know, the challenge of cultivating a home audience. A lot of, like, the private funding that goes to, you know, arts organizations is civically motivated. You know, there's a sense of, I'm giving this arts organization support my local community. And, you know, not having a home makes that more challenging. You know, so that's, you know, what is a home? We're all people, you know, Alarm Will Sound artists live all over the place. It's not like we all live in one place. Right. We have homes in the sense that there are places where we have a reoccurring regular presence and where we're playing enough that we can build an audience. And those places really are St. Louis and New York. And then, you know, in addition to that, there are places where we may play, you know, once every 2 years, once every 5 years, or, you know, once every decade. Like, you know, we went to Russia in, what, 2008, I think, and we haven't gone back there since. So I don't know how much we're doing to be developing our Moscow audience. And in lieu of a reoccurring presence in a place, you know, then you have to think about how can we have a presence there in other ways, which means largely through the internet and recording. So definitely it's useful to have the feeling of a home somewhere, which comes from just being there as a group, you know, on a regular basis. And we have done that in a few places.
From their recording, Alarm Will Sound presents Modernists, this music of the American composer Charles Wuorinen, his work called Big Spinoff. Alarm Will Sound is led by their music director and conductor and my guest today, Alan Pearson. Thank you.
So the last two recordings are kind of fascinating. We talked about the composer portrait series of Miller, and your recordings were sort of single composer, singer, artist based.
Right.
So then comes this modernist recording with this pretty wild assortment on it. I mean, you might want to just run through who's on this disc. I can do it too. But so maybe go through the thought behind that from the opening track to the last track, which is like, and then everybody who you've slotted in between, which is interesting because it takes in sort of generations of various American, what's quote-unquote new and non-American.
Right.
And then the latest recording, which we'll talk about, of a composer you've worked with very often, and a little twist to the recording itself.
Right.
So let's stick
right.
with the modernists first, and just programming that disc.
Yeah, well, the modernist CD actually is our second mixed composer CD.
Yeah.
The one before that was a CD called Arrhythmia. And those two CDs share something, which is that they both are trying to bring together disparate sounding music with diverse audiences in a package that makes sense and is coherent. So when we did the Arrhythmia disc, you know, the unifying concept was music that's playing with time in some way, where, you know, there are multiple kinds of time happening at once, or where time is disrupted. And under that umbrella, we did the Shags, we did Autechre, we did Nan Kiro, we did Benedict Mason, Ligeti, a really like diverse range of music. And that was a disc that we were all really proud of. And then, right, Modernist is doing the same kind of thing around this idea of modernism. And it was fun in that context to bring together, you know, the Beatles and Edgar Varese, and then more contemporary figures like John Orff, who's a member of Alarm Will Sound, Augusta Reed Thomas, Charles Warren, who wrote us a piece, Wolfgang Riem, who also wrote us a piece. Yeah, there too, the idea was to, in some way that had a coherent vision to it, bring together a really diverse range of music that would raise eyebrows in interesting ways and connect with a diverse audience. Revolution 9 is a track of the Beatles that has a cult following and that is very deliberately drawing on the modernist tradition.
Mm.
And so, you know, taking the arrangement of that Matt Marks, our horn player, spectacularly did, and putting it alongside Varese and Wolfgang Riem and Charles Warren, Auguste Reed Thomas, seem both really provocative and, you know, kind of obvious and smart.
Yeah, and you've done that, I mean, in the Varese, you're taking the Poem Electronique and moving it into your realm.
Right.
You've done that often, too, is you've taken music and sort of rearranged it, transcribed it, whatever, for your forces.
Yeah.
Giving it new life, new face, new costume, new whatever you want to. Whatever metaphor you want to give to it. You know, it's a new garb.
Right.
Yeah, so that's... The latest recording is a composer you've worked with often, and you mentioned his piece before, that's John Adams.
Yeah.
The Chamber Symphony is on there, which has been recorded, but then he wrote the sequel, which is not Chamber Symphony 2, or he called it Son of Chamber Symphony.
Right.
And you can get the CD and listen to the CD or download the CD and hear why. It's a very funny story. His publisher wasn't happy, but that's okay. This contains basically a podcast. So two of the tracks are you and who's the historian?
Is that Nadia Sirota?
And Nadia Sirota, but there's a historian from Colombia. Frisch was his last
name. Oh, yeah.
Anyway, apologies to him, but his last name is Frisch. And then Adams himself.
Walter Frisch. Right.
And it sort of moves in and out of different explanations and going through the music and feelings of the group and into rehearsals and all the rest of that stuff. That's an interesting sort of backup on technology, where you take something that is not, you know, a podcast is supposed to sort of live out there and sort of float around the ether and people grab it and listen to it and then put it on a Discord. I'm just curious on the thoughts of doing that and how you got John to say okay to do it.
Yeah, well, keep in mind that also you know, CDs have moved in the direction you're talking about too, where there are things that float around in the ether that you can. Yeah, there was a lot of thinking behind that. One is that we're interested in general bringing storytelling into our work. We feel like and have observed that stories are a way that people really engage with music. And so we were interested. We've done storytelling kinds of shows before. Like, we have a show called 1969, which we performed a number of times around the country. We're doing it in California in the next year. And it's a show that looks at music through the lens of the story of artists dealing with the upheaval of the late 1960s. And I think it's a really successful way to look at music. And so we're interested in doing more of that and in a range of ways. And, you know, Nadia had done amazing work with her Meet the Composer podcast. And so we started playing with this idea of working together on an album in the same way that we had created concerts that had these storytelling elements, working on an album that would have a storytelling element.
We should say she's a violist in Alarm Will Sound.
Right, that's right. Nadia's also a viola player. Right. And in an era where albums were mostly consumed as CDs, you know, this might have been a more problematic idea because, you know, you put a CD on, you press play, and you listen to the whole thing in order, and maybe you don't want to hear a podcast in the middle of your album. But because of the way that people listen to albums now, which is much more as you said earlier, it's all the stuff going through the ether that you grab as you want. The idea of packaging, you know, the storytelling with the music in a way that then, because of how people experience albums now, lets you listen to one or both, you know, as fits your mood at the moment, seemed a really smart and really contemporary way to tell a story in the context of an album. It was a perfect project for that because it's music that we have great stories to tell about, because this is music that we're so deeply connected with. And that, you know, in the case of Chamber Symphony, is part of our own DNA as an ensemble. And in the case of Sun and Chamber Symphony, we're part of its DNA.
You know, he wrote it for you.
He wrote it for us.
Yeah, which is very cool. Yeah, like I said, just sort of turned the clock backwards on it, because you really put this out saying, here's the material, which can live as downloads, but here it lives as a CD. If you did this 20 years ago, it would have been crazy. We went to buy a CD for music, not for talk.
That's right.
But that's not the world we live in. Anymore.
Right.
Number nine.
Once again, back to Alarm Will Sound's recording on the Cantaloupe label called Alarm Will Sound Presents Modernists. Here are a few minutes of Alarm Will Sound member Matt Marks' arrangement of the Beatles' Revolution 9 from their White Album. Alarm Will Sound, led by their music director and conductor and my guest today, Alan Pearson.
Well, is there anything like really that you can talk about? Major that it's really exciting that's going to come up in the next year, 18 months or something like that?
Matt, what can I talk about? What am I allowed to talk about? We're doing a show in this coming March at Carnegie Hall, March 2018, which is another in this series of storytelling, like live podcast-like experiences. So in a similar vein as what we did with Nadia and Meet the Composer in the Adams album, we're doing as a live show, and it's a show we've done before, about Ligeti, and looking at Ligeti's experience as a young man in a series of almost ludicrously difficult situations, you know, in the chaos of Eastern Europe, under the Nazis and under the communists, as a Jew growing up in that part of the world, and looking at both at his story and in the way in which those experiences shaped his music. And so it's a really powerful and emotional story that we've put together that combines the story of his life, and specifically those early years of his life until his escape to the West, the story of that experience with the music that he both was writing then and that he later wrote, which I think in some way looks back at that experience.
That's great, because I've always thought his life should be known in that way, in sort of a dramatic way, what he went through. And weirdly, films have shown that his music has great draw if it's used.
I mean, it's very strange,
you think, but there's been films where, you know, Ligeti's been a major part of the soundtrack, and they've been very successful.
Yeah, I mean, right, he's an incredibly dramatic composer.
Yeah.
I was really drawn to his story and felt like it wasn't one that had been told a lot.
Right.
The story of his escape from the East to the West, repeated escapes really, is incredibly dramatic and sort of impossible, or at least like highly improbable. It's an amazing story that hasn't gotten told a lot, and I really see it in his music, and that's also not something that I've seen talked about a lot. But I think there are lots of ways in which his music, even what he wrote quite late in his life, reflects those early, really like terrifying and dangerous experiences.
Yeah. We can't really fathom, you know, waking up every day not knowing if your life was going to continue or if you're going to be caught or whatever, that whole thing. Waiting to knock on the door, right? Well, I said we'd round back to this to close off the interview. Ben, so I asked you to start why a group of you at Eastman thought you had to form an ensemble like this.
Right.
So here we are, 2017. In, you know, 2027, 2037, looking ahead, I see these as different. Could an ensemble like this continue and be there years to come? And the other one is, should it be?
Huh. You mean, could a new ensemble?
Yeah, could an ensemble like this, I mean, I know there's new ones popping up and all that.
Yeah, there sure are.
But do you sense in the climate of giving these concerts, trying to get funding, trying to make everything happen and keep the plates juggling, that this can continue to happen for a group like yours or groups that come along? Can they sustain something like this as we can?
Yeah, I think so. The scene is always changing. Yeah. There are a lot more new music ensembles now than were when we started up. And when I talk with people who are thinking about starting groups and talk with them about the challenges they face, I do think that they have a higher bar to hit in terms of defining themselves than we hit. Because, you know, the question, how are you different than what's already out there, I think is a more challenging question to answer now than it was when we were starting out.
Yeah.
And probably the funding climate is harder than it was when we were starting out. But, you know, like one great thing that young groups have going for them, which older, more established groups don't, as a rule, is a lot of time on their hands and a willingness to work for free or for something close to free.
Yeah.
And energy. That always gives a certain advantage to the upstart.
Well, the other one is should, because I know there's ensembles dedicated to early music. I get that, because there's different instrumentation, different tuning, things like that. The instruments change. And in other arts, okay, we have a contemporary art museum, I guess.
Yeah.
But I mean, should groups that have to say, we play the newest music, can we get past that? I mean, should we have new music groups in 10 years, 20 years, or should we get past that music is music, you know, the Ellington thing? But
yeah, I'm not so into shoulds. I don't know, to me, like, shoulds are more for critics than for artists.
Okay.
And, you know, like, if some young group of artists has an idea for an ensemble, let them go try to do it and see what they can make with it. I do think that there are specific challenges to this kind of instrumentation, this kind of music, that are really different than what you do in, say, an orchestra. And that the way to do what we do at the highest level is this unique kind of playing that's not orchestra playing, it's not solo playing, it's closest to chamber music playing, but it's a little different from everything else. You know, people who play in an orchestra and are really good at playing in an orchestra may not be the best people for it.
Yeah.
And it's not even the best people. That's not even really the way to say it. The best ensemble. That, you know, if you take a really great orchestra and then take its first chair players and put them in a new music ensemble, you know, they're all great players and they play in a great orchestra together. It's suddenly a different kind of thing and a different kind of playing. And yeah, I do think that it makes sense to have that kind of playing have its own space and its own ensemble rather than just trying to make it something that, you know, members of an orchestra do occasionally.
Well, let me just rephrase. It still has the word should in it, unfortunately, but should there be labels? I mean, you are labeled a new music ensemble.
Right.
It would be nice in my mind to move past the labeling of just you are Alarm Will Sound. And though people go to hear you, they should expect to hear the newer music.
Right.
I don't think that that has to be, you know, the cardboard box, you know,
right.
type of thing. That's what
right.
I hope would break down, but, you know.
Although, you know, for a group like us, just by necessity, you know, Mozart and Haydn didn't write for our instrumentation, so we're not going to be playing that. There are groups like Knights out there, who I really admire,
yeah.
who will do, you know, Beethoven, and then also will do, right. you know, really recent stuff. And I think tackle that all with a lot of authenticity and flair and panache. But our instrumentation does, you know, in a way that I'm totally comfortable with, put us in a bit of a box in that, you know, we aren't going to be playing the romantic repertoire. It just, it wasn't written for us.
Right. Well, I wish you continued success and you can blow past 20 years and keep going. I close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. The
yeah.
first is hypothetical. If you had a chance to chat with somebody from the past and you couldn't, whose brain would you love to pick for just a few minutes?
Oh, wow.
Just the first name that pops in. I can't think about it.
First thing that pops into me in my mind right now is John Dowland, just because I've been listening to
wow.
a bunch of his stuff right now. And yeah, really curious to know what his life was like and what kind of person he was that he wrote the music he wrote.
Sad person, I think.
Maybe.
We don't know. The music might have been belying something else. You are the first person in 12 years to pick Dowland.
Awesome. Cool. Happy to throw you a curveball.
There you go. Final question is non-musical. Everybody I interview fills their life with music is very busy. You're very busy. With it. When you have to do something that is non-musical, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what pull you away from what do you do?
Yeah. For me, that's about time with people who are close to me.
Yeah.
And though activity is less important to me, it might be going to see theater, it might be cooking, it might be going hiking, but it's about quality and depth of companionship and human relationship.
What you deal with often in Alarm Will Sound, time.
Yes, right.
Alan Pearson, thanks.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Co-founder, artistic director, conductor, and keyboardist of the ensemble Alarm Will Sound, Alan Pearson. You can find out more about Alarm Will Sound at their website, alarmwillsound.com. Their recordings can be found on the Cantaloupe Music label. Check them out at Cantaloupe, Cantaloupe, music.com. Their latest release is a recording devoted to the Chamber Symphony and the Son of Chamber Symphony, composed specifically for Alarm Will Sound by American composer John Adams. In addition to the performances of these two works, there is a podcast interspersed featuring my guest, Nadia Sirota, violist in Alarm Will Sound and WQXR radio host, and also composer John Adams. I'll leave you with the composer talking about the odd title for this work, followed by the voice of my guest, Alan Pearson, and then we'll hear the final movement from Son of Chamber Symphony by John Adams. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musician of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and wwfm.org.
Much to the horror of my publisher, I told him I didn't want to call it Chamber Symphony No. 2. Which I thought would be bad luck anyway, because Schoenberg never finished his. So I said, let's call it Son of Chamber Symphony, which they didn't go for, but anyway, that's what it's called.
It's a reference to pulp horror films of the 50s and 60s and 70s. So, you know, like Bride of Frankenstein. Of course, you know, it's also referring to his first chamber symphony, which by the time he wrote this piece for us in 2007... had become a classic.